Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 17th of December. I'm so happy we have Doris Kearns Goodwin with us this hour. And what a book she has written. She began this book, which is titled The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, seven years ago. And her intention was to write about Teddy Roosevelt and the progressive era, because what a time that was in American history. But she found that she was just captivated by other parts of that time. And so she has put together three interwoven strands. One, the story of Theodore Roosevelt. The next strand, the story of William Howard Taft, who she says his talents and skills played a more significant role in the Roosevelt administration than is generally understood. And third, this incredible group of journalists. And she writes, the vitality of democracy depends on popular knowledge of complex questions. So the people in McClure's magazine really wrote in compelling fashion about the issues of the day and exposed wrongs, and the Roosevelt administration in some cases set out to fix those wrongs. Doris Kearns Goodwin is very esteemed historian. She's author of Team of Rivals, in part the basis for Steven Spielberg's picture Lincoln. She was awarded the Pulitzer in History for No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, and also author of Wait Till Next Year, The Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. And she is a commentator when it comes to these historical subjects and the current presidency as well, on TV and radio and all over the place. I hope some of you have had a chance to read the book. There are at least 50 other books involved in this book, so I'm anxious to see where she will go next. But first, where she has been for the past 7 years. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you so much for being with us.
I am delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Yeah, great to have you here. I love the book so much, and there are at least, don't you think, at least 50 other books to be found.
Realization for how fat it is.
But there are so many compelling stories. All these personalities were just, oh my gosh, what a cast of characters. You start the book, and it really says a lot about who Teddy Roosevelt was and the hopes and aspirations that he embodied for people who lived in this country. His return to American shores after a year's safari in Africa, and the crowd that greeted him, Doris, it was something.
No, it really did show. I mean, here's a former president just coming back after a year, and there's more than a million people waiting in New York.
Wow.
Having waited for days, you know. I love the examples of some of them. They said they just told their boss, I can't come to work. I have to go see Teddy. There was a sense of intimacy that the public felt toward him. I mean, these huge teddy bears on the, you know, and bully for you, Teddy. Everything showed that they felt connected to him, which I think was the strength of his presidency. He had an emotional ability to talk in shorthand language, to reach the public in ways that they loved his colorful personality and his bear hunts and his game and his bird observations and his interest in a thousand things. So it helped him get his progressive agenda through, that they had that sense of his person.
Mm-hmm. And while that reception was taking place in New York, William Howard Taft was where?
William Howard Taft was in Washington, and then he went off on his own trip because he knew that he shouldn't probably go to New York. He would look like a supplicant. People wanted him to go and maybe greet Roosevelt coming in, but he was the President of the United States, and he was always aware of the dignity of the importance of that office. So he goes himself out to give a series of speeches, and typically bad luck that always attended Taft, it seemed, and good luck reached Roosevelt. Roosevelt has a beautiful, sunny day. It only rains for a little while he's inside, stops raining when he's outside. Taft is drenched with rain.
Oh.
As he's giving commencement addresses, they have to be put inside. And later, much, you know, earlier actually, when he had his inauguration, and he and Teddy were together in the morning of Taft's inauguration at the White House, and it was a blizzard outside, and Taft said, I always knew there'd be a blizzard when I became president. So it was called Roosevelt luck, the good weather, and Taft's bad luck, the bad weather.
Mm. Let's spend some time on Roosevelt because he was probably the more popular of the two when it comes to presidents. But it was interesting to me, as you trace in great detail and so interestingly his family upbringing, that this guy, this kid who was so sickly for so long, built himself up physically, but built his mind because he was interested in absolutely everything. He just never wasted a minute.
Oh, it's true. I mean, he has the most focus and the most energetic mind and body, I think, that I've read about. And it's often said, and I know I believe it from the presidents I've lived with, that something happens in their childhoods or young adulthoods that's really difficult. And the ability to withstand that adversity and come through trials of fire really is a crucible for them when they become a later. Certainly for FDR, it was his polio. For Lincoln, his whole difficulty in educating himself, a self-made man in many respects. And for Teddy, you know, if he'd just grown up in that aristocratic family, had that special life that he had, without having to encounter that life-threatening asthma, which you're absolutely right, he then refashioned his body in order to give himself the power to combat the asthma, and then later having a wife that dies in childbirth, who he adored, and coming through those struggles, I think, as he said, it gave him perspective. If he lost elections or gained elections, it didn't seem as sorrow as deep or joy as keen either way, so he could get through it.
Mm-hmm. He also didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about what had been.
That's correct. I mean, I'm sure a psychiatrist might say today, somewhat unhealthy. For example, after his first wife, Alice, died in childbirth, he hardly ever wanted to use the word Alice again. And it was hard because the little daughter who was born lived, and her name was Alice. And so for years he just called her baby and then didn't even talk about her, really, in the memoir. And so that was his way of shutting out things that were tough in the past, but I'm not sure that it's the healthiest way. I mean, in comparison to Lincoln, when his little son Willie died, he always wanted to talk about him. He somehow felt that it made him come back to life by telling stories about him to people who would visit in the office.
You say that both Teddy Roosevelt, or T.D. Roosevelt, and William Howard Taft were the favorite children in their families, and particularly close to their fathers. How did they become the favorite children? Did they know they were the favorite children?
I think they did know it. I mean, it's interesting. And what's so interesting in both cases is that Taft had a series of brothers. I mean, he had two older brothers from his father's first marriage. The first wife had died. And then two more brothers and a sister from his parents' second marriage. And they all said that he was clearly the favorite, but he was so kindly and so good and the mediator between all of them that they didn't mind it somehow. He didn't evoke jealousy. And similarly with Teddy Roosevelt, his sisters would say, and maybe his younger brother Elliot had some difficulty with Teddy being the favorite because he was the one who had epilepsy, who eventually becomes an alcoholic, and who eventually marries Eleanor Roosevelt's mother. So this whole thing was so wonderfully intertwined.
Yes.
But I think they both were really close to their fathers, and both of their fathers were interested in social justice at a time, you know, in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, when after the Civil War, it was really just making money and, you know, that whole Industrial Revolution, and there were lots of problems that were coming up from the tenements, and they both cared about those things, which I think they passed on mm-hmm. to their sons, Will and Teddy.
Mm-hmm. Did it create confusion at all in Teddy's mind to have his mother come from the South and support the Confederacy and his father support the Union?
I think it probably did. I mean, his mother was still so passionate about the Confederacy, and I think the real problem was not only at dinner table, as later was described, they couldn't talk about the war because she would get so upset, but more importantly, his father, who would have easily and wanted to be a soldier in the war, was so afraid that if he did, it would produce a real difficulty because the mother was kind of frail and passionate anyway. So he hired a volunteer instead of himself. And I think later for Teddy, when he discovered that, and he loved that father so much, it was a really hard thing for him. And it may have exaggerated his need to prove himself in battle, as he did in The Rough Rider, as he does much later when he gets shot in the middle of the 1912 campaign by an assassin, and he insists on giving his speech. Courage then became almost an overarching virtue in order to make up for the sadness he felt about his father.
Mm. You talk about both fathers having concerns, social justice kinds of concerns. They both, though, grew up in pretty wealthy families, Teddy particularly. Did their Teddy and William's social sense of social justice develop further beyond their fathers? And if so, was it the journalists who did that for them, or what was it?
Well, I think what happens is they start out with sort of a like a conservative sense of we have to try and make things better for the people who are in the tenements or in the factories. But at the beginning, it was more of noblesse oblige. You know, we'll do it philanthropically. That's certainly what Teddy's father did. But then once Teddy gets into the state legislature, and he's very young, it's right after college, and at first he's not in favor of government regulation. He still thinks we can do it this other way. But then he sees the conditions in the factories and the tenements because he goes out. That's what he always did in every job he had. And he realizes, no, we have to have some government responsibility for this. And that was a big leap at that time because it was almost like a religious conviction that laissez-faire was what made the economy strong. And government had no role whatever in the political or social or economic life of the country. And so he begins to shift then. And then as the country shifts, you know, as the problems get greater with the big companies forming and the Standard Oil and the trains, you know, developing across the country and small business being squelched, and as ordinary life gets harder for people and that gap grows between the rich and the poor, he then moves educationally with the country. And interestingly, so does Taft up to a certain point, up till 1912, essentially. They're pretty much together in where they think the government should be.
Mm. Now, Taft is an interesting character, but I must tell you, Doris, that Edith was the one who captivated me. Was she something or what?
Oh, she's really something.
Really?
She's such a romantic, too. I love that part of her. I mean, here's this young girl who grows up very close to the Union Square neighborhood, wealthy neighborhood where Teddy is. Her father is also wealthy but loses his business and becomes an alcoholic, and they have to move from one house to another, but she forever draws this protective curtain around herself and adores Teddy. They are best friends. When he goes to Europe for a year when he's 11, he cries at the thought of leaving little Edith behind. They become adolescent boyfriend and girlfriend. Then somewhere along the line, and after his sophomore year in college, they have a break. And nobody ever talked about exactly what happened, but he then goes back his junior year at Harvard, falls immediately in love with this young woman named Alice Lee, a beauty. Probably not with the depth of mind as Edith, although nobody knows, and she was so young when she died. And it's devastating to Edith, but she still goes to his wedding as his friend and thinks that that's it. And then Edith finds out, of course, that Alice died in childbirth. And eventually Teddy comes back from the Badlands where he went to recover from his depression and sees Edith again. And within weeks, they are back together again, and she's absolutely the right wife for him. I mean, she shared his literary passion. She's really strong, and he needed that sanctuary that she wants nothing more than but to give him a home. She wasn't interested in being a politician's wife. She had no desire to have her views imposed upon the country, but she simply wanted to give him a sanctuary and a home, which is what she'd wanted her whole life. And boy, she did that. And
yeah.
She was a great wife and mother.
And Taft's wife, an unconventional woman, you describe her that way. Was she ever?
Absolutely. I mean, here's young Nellie Heron Taft growing up in a middle-class family and very intelligent. Even in her diary when she's young, she'll talk about being blue as indigo because she wants something vital in her life. And her brothers are going off to Harvard and Yale, but the father tells her, you're not going. And she's supposed to come out in society, but instead she goes and works in a school. Her mother warns her that this may hurt her social standing, and she thinks she won't marry so that she can accomplish something. She actually loved going to the beer halls in Cincinnati with her friends, talking politics with the laborers. And finally she meets young Will Taft, who not only adores her, but promises her that she will be his partner in everything he does, and she truly is. I mean, she becomes his strategist. She's the one who loves politics more than he did. He often said he would have remained a judge, which was his dream from the time he was young, in Cincinnati had he not been with Nellie. And she really spurs him on at every stage of his career and becomes, you know, an integral part of his political success.
We welcome phone calls. Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest. The book is filled with so much we've yet to even touch on the journalists and what a cast of characters were involved there, writing mostly for McClure's magazine. The founder of the magazine has one story to tell of coming over absolutely penniless from Europe, and some of the other members, fine writers who really did investigative pieces that came to the attention of the American public and helped, I don't think it's an overstatement to say they helped shape the direction of legislation that the Roosevelt administration took up, the concerns that were part of the administration, partially fashioned by all that had been written about. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Her book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Doris Kearns Goodwin and start with Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for having your guest on. Kathleen, do you remember James Bradley, the Imperial Cruise? I think you had him on as a guest a few years back, maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Yes, I remember.
And, you know, I can't remember much of, I read the book about, right about that time, so I don't remember a whole lot of the book. But I did read a little bit of your guest book just a few days ago, and I was just looking at the what she had to say about the cruise that Taft took with Alice to the Philippines, the Korea, and Japan. And his interpretation of what happened seems a little bit more cynical than what she had to say about the cruise. And regarding the press, from what Bradley was saying, the press was just really being used, that Roosevelt used his daughter as a circus show to sidetrack the reporters from covering the real story, and that was the illegal, unconstitutional treaties off the books treaties that were made between Japan and the United States, and how, and I guess the final conclusion of Bradley was, this is what landed us in World War II.
Oh, I'd be glad to try and answer that. I mean, I have read the book, so I know where he's going, and I think he's right about some things. I mean, I think he's certainly right that some of those treaties set us on a path with the relationship with Japan. And it does end up, you know, many, many years later with World War II. But I don't know that the direct connection, so many other things intervened that could have changed, and that journey might have gone in a different direction. As far as Alice goes, I mean, first of all, let me say, I mean, I don't think the occupation of the Philippines was the right thing. So I'm with him on that. But the reason Taft was interesting as the choice of the governor generalship was that he, too, was against the occupation of the Philippines. And it was because of that, in part, that McKinley originally wanted him to go to the Philippines, because he knew that instead of a rah-rah person, he might have some cynical nature himself about the military, which needed to be dealt with in the Philippines. But as far as using Alice, I think it's really hard to say anybody could use Alice. I mean, she had a mind of her own. She became this extraordinary figure. And, you know, he once said about her, I can either be president or I can control Alice. And I have to be president. She's also the one, because she herself had a certain kind of cynical mind, saying about her father, you know, that he wanted so much to be in the center of attention, that he wanted to be the baby at the baptism, the corpse at the funeral, and the bride at the wedding. So I think there's pieces of that that I would agree with. My take on it was, because I was interested in Taft's character and how he created camaraderie among these people, I wasn't writing about foreign policy in the same way. It was mostly the progressive era, domestic stuff. So he went into more depth in that part of it than I did myself.
Thanks for the call, Mike. There was a time, you write, at the height of their careers, and I'm wondering, Doris, when that was, when Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft stood shoulder to shoulder as they charted a different role for the U.S. government that would enlarge economic opportunity and social justice. Where were they at that time, and what did they do?
Well, I would say that probably the height of both of their careers was probably 1905 and 1906. 1906 is when so much of the legislation gets passed that really defines the progressive part of TR's presidency. You get the Food and Drug Act passed. You get the meatpacking at plant stuff passed. You get the railroad abuses taken care of, and the antitrust suits are moving along. And Taft, at that point, agrees with Teddy that the government has to take these actions. In fact, he took even more antitrust actions than Teddy did when he became president. But the reason I think of them standing shoulder to shoulder is that Teddy traveled the country a lot during that period of time because he wanted to go on these whistle-stop tours to educate the country about the need for government regulation of some of these problems brought about by the Industrial Revolution. And he'd be gone for a couple months at a time, and then reporters would say to him, what are we going to do? What is going to happen in your absence? And he said, oh, don't worry, Taft will be sitting on the lid. And then, of course, these huge cartoons of this big Taft sitting on the lid of all the problems. But it wasn't the Secretary of State, interestingly, and it wasn't the Vice President that was in charge. It really was Taft. So they had such differences in temperament, certainly in physical strength, one being, you know, this manic physical guy and Taft being far more sedentary given his weight. And they had different personalities. Taft admired Teddy's fiery rhetoric. He was much more of a lawyer when he spoke. And Teddy admired Taft's personality because everybody liked him, more than liked him initially. So together, I think they really were there at that peak moment. And then, of course, it all breaks apart later.
How does it break apart? Why does it break apart?
Well, it's a complicated story, more than I knew. I mean, all that we knew beforehand was that Taft is handpicked by Teddy to be his successor. He runs Taft's campaign, essentially, in 1908. The reason there is a campaign is that Teddy had made a pledge when he won in 1904 that he would have essentially served 7.5 years since McKinley's assassination, so he wouldn't run for what might have seemed like a third term. He later said he would have done anything to have taken that pledge back. Mm-hmm. He really still wanted to be president. But the next best thing is to have your close friend, who you've known for 20 years, become your successor. And then he goes off to Africa, and then, as you pointed out, he comes back to that huge applause. And I think he's told by the progressives that Taft hasn't been what they thought he would. And part of it is true. He never moved further. He stayed where he and Teddy had been in 1906, 1907, 1908, and the progressives were moving toward even more social legislation and more economic regulation, and Taft stayed there. But more importantly, he just didn't understand how to become a public figure. So he tried to do something Teddy never did, a tariff reform. It split the party even more, and the progressives were disappointed that he didn't get more than he should have, even though Teddy had never even done it. So they started turning on him. And then when they approached Teddy and said, you have to be our banner, we need you, I think he always wanted to get back into the presidency again. So he ends up deciding to run against Taft for the nomination in 1912, and it becomes a brutal, brutal fight. It's almost as if, as close as they were as friends, they almost had to exaggerate their differences in order to get through the campaign.
And then at the end of the book, they meet again in Chicago, I believe. It's kind of a touching scene, isn't it?
I was so happy to find that. You know, I just, after living with these people for so long as I had and seeing how close friends they had once been and knowing how difficult that campaign was, I just decided, well, what happens after 1912? Maybe something good happens. So I decided to follow them. And at first, because they, of course, both lose to Woodrow Wilson. They split the Republican vote. Wilson becomes president. And various friends and political allies try to bring Taft and Teddy together, but it's still, for the first 5-6 years, almost like an armed neutrality. There's too much bitterness left. But then in Chicago in 1918, only maybe 8 months or so before Teddy's going to die at age 60, they meet in the Blackstone Hotel, totally coincidentally. Teddy's having dinner alone. Taft comes in, goes into the dining room, goes over to Teddy, and there'd been some prior breaking of the ice because Teddy'd been in the hospital and Taft had written him something. Then he wrote back. But he puts his arms around him. The entire audience then applauds. Because they know, thank God there was a reporter there. Those women were so happy that there's a reporter there. And they both said they were so happy it happened. Because then, not long thereafter, Teddy dies. And when Taft goes to his funeral, you know, he said, he told his sister, I would have felt terrible the rest of my life if we hadn't come together at that last moment.
Yeah. Let's go to Alan in Combined Locks. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I just finished a book last night, and I was really amazed at the literary skill that the muckrakers, or Ari the Tar Builder, at McClure's, how they put their magazine together, and the amount of time that they would spend researching, you know, into Standard Oil or the railroads, et cetera, et cetera. And also, as I read the book, it was just, it must have been a great source of information that you could get from all the newspapers that existed at this time in our country.
Oh, no question. I mean, you know, for many times for an historian, newspapers and certainly magazines at the time are the first draft of history. And the great thing that I had lucky into for this book was because I was writing about these people at McClure's magazine, and they are still considered perhaps the best group of journalists ever to be in one place at one time. Ida Tarbell, Ray Baker, William Allen White, Lincoln Steffens. And as you said, they were given a couple years to do their research so that when their pieces came out on Standard Oil or the railroads or the meatpacking plants or food and drugs, they were impregnable. I mean, they were really fact-based. They were the first staff reporters, really. Up till that time, mostly you got paid however much you wrote for somebody, not as a complete member of a magazine staff. And they loved what they were doing. They had a sense of mission, a sense of call. Even later in their lives, they get together, as you know, having finished it, you know, coming back and looking at this period with nostalgia when they knew they were changing the world in a little way, because their stories had an educational impact on the country, which allowed Roosevelt then to pressure the Congress from the outside in to get something done to deal with these problems.
And McClure had a real talent for identifying fine American writing. He really brought some subsequently famous American writers to the forefront.
No, without a question. I really felt a great identification, you know, and just wanting to make this guy come back to life, because he had a difficult life, you know, coming over from Ireland, and his father dies over there, real poverty when he comes to America, finally gets to Knox College, and dreams of creating this magazine. And then you're right, he just had an instinct for talent, and he put together this staff, and he was a manic depressive probably in today's terms, so his periods of depression were really difficult, and they knew so little about what to do with it then. They would send him to sanitariums in Europe where he would be fed milk for 3 weeks only, and hoping to replace the blood with milk somehow, the bad blood with good blood. And in his manic phrases, he was a genius, but sometimes went overboard, so there was lots of tension in this group, but Ida Tarbell was like the mother hen. She could always keep them together. So it was an extraordinarily fascinating group to read about and to use their writing, as the questioner said. You know, their writing was so good that I could quote them and know that I've got really rich language as a result of it.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little, this is kind of a sidelight, but I was interested in your story about Ida Tarbell giving the assignment of writing about Abraham Lincoln, and spending three years with McClure's writing this, didn't she?
Absolutely. And again, she sought out a different channel. I mean, a lot had already been written about Abraham Lincoln at that time. The big biography by Nicolay and Hay, his assistance, was done. But she went and interviewed people, just sort of really moving around from one place to another in Illinois, who would have been possibly in contact with Lincoln. So they were like older people at the time, but she got their stories about Lincoln, and then she was able to contribute something really fresh. I remember when I was starting the book on Lincoln, I read something that she had said. Somebody said to her, why do so many people want to write about Lincoln? This is even then, right? Before the 14,000 books now. She said, because he's so companionable. And I love that, because that's what I felt, too. It was so much fun living with Lincoln.
Oh, I'll bet it was fun living with Lincoln. Is it easy to find that book, her writing now, Doris?
Yes. Yeah, you can still find those books.
Okay.
You have to go sometimes on the special book tours to find them. But, yes, they've lasted. I mean, I used them, you know, before I knew I was doing this. She was a source for me on the Lincoln book as well.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest, and our phone number, if you'd like to join our conversation, I'm particularly interested in hearing from you if you've started the book, and we had somebody who finished the book last night. Alan did. Thanks, Alan, for your call. The book is The Bully Pulpit. It is a New York Times bestseller, and it's just fascinating. Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. Our phone number is 800-486-8255. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Getting back to the newspapers and the print in those days, we, of course, have television now and radio. But you even were writing about the number of journalists who were covering the state legislature when Teddy Roosevelt was there. And there were all these print journalists. This just doesn't happen anymore.
No, I mean, it was really interesting. They formed their own little camaraderie. You know, they're in the Albany area. They all go out together. Teddy gets to know them pretty well. I mean, there's dozens of them. There was even a, I remember seeing a picture once of the map where they would all sit, you know, in the state legislature when somebody was giving a speech, so that, you know, that newspapers were the key at that time. You know, that what's so interesting about looking at leadership is it seems to me that the presidents who do well understand whatever the medium is of their time. So Teddy understood that newspapers, print newspapers, and magazines were the main thing. FDR comes along as the voice and the young person of radio. He knew that was the way to reach the people in his fireside chats. JFK and Reagan understand perfectly the medium of television. And it's more complicated today to figure out about that bully pulpit that was so useful to all of them, because it's so much more fragmented today. Even if a president gives a speech, you know, it could be on a cable network. You're just watching your favorite cable network. You don't hear the whole speech. You hear the pundits taking it down, and we break news for something very soon thereafter.
Yes.
So, but these people had the attention of the country when they spoke, which is really important. That's what the whole point of the bully pulpit is, as Teddy defined it.
Yeah. Mary Kay in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to tell Doris Goodwin that I admire her so much. I've read several of her books. I haven't gotten her latest one yet, but I've seen her often on some of the talk shows, MSNBC in particular, and I think she is not only an erudite woman, very, very articulate and well-spoken, but she's such a good person to listen to, because she,
yes,
maybe because of her knowledge of history, she doesn't jump to the right, to the left. She's really somebody you can listen to and believe in.
Well, thank you so very much. That's great. I appreciate that. That's what I hope, too. I mean, that's the whole hope, that you can use history to understand the struggles and the triumphs of people who lived before and learn something from it, you know, rather than being enmeshed in the battles of the moment.
Yes. Thank you, Mary Kay, so much for the call. 800-486-8655 is our number. And when you say, it's kind of hard to imagine this, Doris, but when you say you spent 7 years, not only with Teddy, but with Taft and with all of these other characters in the book, what does that mean for you on a day-to-day basis? Are you with these people all the time, writing something, reading about them, or do you find that you need to take a long break from them for a while, for you know, months or something?
No, pretty much. I mean, except for, you know, the Lincoln movie came out in, you know, in these last couple years.
Yes.
So I was working on that and, you know, seeing the drafts that Tony Kushner had written. I went with Daniel Day-Lewis to Springfield, Illinois.
Oh, you did?
Yep,
oh, wonderful. Oh, that must have been a great assignment.
He's the best. We became friends, and I went down to Richmond to the filming. So I like to rationalize that maybe, you know, a year or so could be shaved off the 7 years. But in general, the first couple years, you're just reading in the period and figuring out what it is you want to write. And then there's so many letters and so many diaries and private journals and newspapers that I just have to develop chronologies over time, so that I have probably, you know, 50 notebooks, each one of which might cover like 1901, you know, from January to June, 1901 from June, you know, to December, and then all those years in between. And it does still, it does become part of you. I remember when the kids were little, my boys, they used to hear me when I was writing about Franklin and Eleanor, as if I were talking to Franklin and Eleanor. You know, Franklin, just be nicer to her. She's sensitive. Or, Eleanor, forget that affair of so long ago. And then the same thing with Taft and Teddy. You know, just keep that friendship. Don't say these things. I know you don't believe that he's got the brain of a guinea pig, which is what Teddy said of Taft. He knew that Taft was smart. You know, so it does become part of your life. It may be an odd profession to spend one days with dead presidents, but I wouldn't change it.
Well, you've spent time with the greats, with Abraham Lincoln, with Roosevelt, with
both Roosevelts.
Lincoln, yeah, with both Roosevelts. With Lincoln, are there other greats who captivate you and you will delve another 7 years into their story or not?
I don't know. I mean, what I'm thinking of doing now, I mean, obviously, you know, there, you could go back to Jefferson and Washington, but
right.
so many good books have been written about them, and it's a whole other century that I don't think I know that much about.
Mm-hmm.
It was scary enough to go back to Lincoln and the Civil War because everything else had been, for me, 20th century. But I think what I'd like to do is bring the great ones together, whether that's FDR and Teddy and Lincoln and obviously my early initial understanding from Lyndon Johnson, and write about leadership. Because underneath all these books is an understanding of what it takes, you know, to be a leader in America, in our democracy. So if I just bring them together and I look at the different traits and then use stories from my guys to illustrate it, then it shouldn't take me 7 years of research. I just may take time to think. Maybe that'll take longer, but I don't think so.
Yeah. Let's go to Lynn in Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello to your guest.
Hello.
I haven't read the book. I'm anxious to. I did read Theodore Rex, and I have an issue with Teddy being called a progressive. My great-grandfather, Clemens Płotek, and his brother-in-law, Matthias Chaya, were murdered September 10, 1897, at the Latimer Massacre for nothing other than union organizing. And what I was led to believe, reading Theodore Rex, was that Teddy was terrified of unions. And to me, it is unions that set America apart in her democracy.
I agree with you totally on unions, and I think that there are things that he says early on when there are violent strikes that I just hate. I mean, all these people that you write about them, you have great respect for them, but there's always parts of them that you don't agree with. I don't agree with Teddy's attitude toward war when he said that the victories of war are greater by far than the victories of peace. But on the other hand, if you watched him evolve from that period you're talking about in 1897 through his own presidency, he becomes more and more aware of the importance of unions. He does things that unions want him to do in terms of working conditions, and he recognizes that they are much more important and have to be dealt with in a good way than he did at the beginning. So similarly, people who are disappointed with Lincoln when he doesn't start out as an abolitionist, but he becomes somebody who understands that slavery has to be abolished and changes as time goes by. You may have wished that he'd been that way at the beginning,
right.
but it doesn't define them as a whole person.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more. We think of him for many things, but really we think of him a great deal for conservation, for his love of nature. Where did that come from, Doris?
I think it comes from several sources. Really, partly it comes from the fact that as a child, because he had this life-threatening asthma, he couldn't partake in the normal vigorous activities. So he became a bird watcher, and he loved birds and wrote about them and just kept, you know, pictures of them from the time he was little. And then he started going out to places because of his asthma. He needed open spaces, and he went to Maine, and he went to, you know, things that would help him with the asthma. And then after his first wife, Alice, died, I think the formative thing was when he went to the Badlands, he was so depressed, and he went and got a ranch. And he later said that constant activity prevented overthought. And he loved the idea of just being out in, you know, on his horseback in the mountains or in the desert or in the various areas where there were spaces. So he eventually realized as president that a lot of these places were being used for private exploitation for the mineral rights or the oil rights or, you know, water rights that would be on them. So he began to conserve them. And, of course, probably has the great legacy of more than any other president of being the conservationist
yes.
president.
He used the phrase, or just the word, delighted.
Right.
That's nice.
Delighted. Exactly. And, of course, he used the phrase bully, too, which meant
right.
something very different from now, but it meant splendid or great or, in today's words, awesome, I suppose.
You know, he was, and tell us this story simply because people in Wisconsin will resonate with this, but there was an assassination attempt on his life just about a block from where I am right now. There's a little marker. I keep thinking there should be a statue of him in Milwaukee here out on the street somewhere, but it's just a little marker in a hotel right now. But it's such a story. Actually, a lot of people in Wisconsin aren't all that familiar with the fact that it happened right here.
I know. That's what's so amazing about history. I mean, you could be walking right past that
yes,
place.
Yes.
And here this huge event took place in October of 1912. So So he had come to Milwaukee to give a big speech, and he was just getting into the car to be taken to the place where he was going to give the speech, and an assassin was there who was probably partly crazy, because he talked about avenging McKinley somehow, but he also was against the idea of a third term, and he shoots at him, and he hits him right in the chest, and he then insists, even though he's been hit in the chest with the bullet, on going to the speech and delivering the speech. They finally go into something like a green room ahead
Amazing.
Of time, and they see the blood. You know, they realize that he has been shot in the chest. The only thing that prevented him from being killed was that he had his huge speech in his pocket, his inner pocket, which had 50 pages, and it was folded over, and his spectacle glass was there, container for the spectacles. And as a result, the bullet didn't go straight. It went upward, but they never got the bullet out of his chest. He was in the hospital for a week after that, and they just had to be careful whether there was sepsis or something else might have been on the bullet. It could have been a laced bullet. But it remained in his chest the rest of his life. And it was a serious shot. And that's that part of him that just insisted until he began to wobble. And they finally said, you have to get to the hospital. And he just insisted he had come to give the speech, and he was going to deliver it.
Isn't
no
that a story?
What.
I mean, it wasn't a little speech. It wasn't high, you know. It was an hour-long speech, and he had a bullet in his chest.
I know. And people, one time, one of the people went up to him and said, isn't it time for you to go? No. He said, no, I will. And finally, when he couldn't do it anymore, he said, okay, I'll go with you now. And he went with the doctors to the hospital.
Quite a story. Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest. And we're welcoming your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Her latest book, it's been anxiously awaited, and it's fulfilling its promise that it would be a good book. It really is. It's The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. So we'll take more of your calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. A couple emails that have come in, Doris. Deborah in Milwaukee wants to know what Teddy did specifically with Standard Oil.
Well, what happened is after Ida Tarbell wrote this big piece, 12 or 14-part series on Standard Oil, he decided that he had to file an antitrust suit, that the Standard Oil really had used illegal and unfair means to accumulate its strength over all the other independent oil companies. And the suit actually does go up through the system and finally does achieve, and the Supreme Court agrees with the Justice Department. It's actually in Taft's administration when it finally comes to fruition. But the interesting thing was, even then the newspaper said that much of the argument of the Justice Department was based on Ida Tarbell's findings. So that must have made her feel pretty great to know that she'd had. Now, so Standard Oil then gets broken up into 38 different parts, including Exxon and Mobil and Sunoco and Standard Oil of New Jersey. So all the ones we know today were once part of that big Standard Oil.
Mm-hmm. Jeff in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, Doris. I'm Heather Cole's father.
Hey, hello. Glad to hear your voice.
Who's Heather?
Small world. I'm waiting to read the book. I'm going to steal her copy. But I just want to say hello, and I'm waiting to read the book because I'm a huge Teddy Roosevelt fan, so it will be fascinating, I think.
Jeff, who is your daughter?
Heather Cole. She's the curator of the Theodore Roosevelt Collection at Harvard.
Oh!
She was so helpful to me because I was so late in getting everything done. And the pictures had to be done. You usually do them when you're leisurely finished, but I only had, weeks to put the pictures together. And so many of them came from the TR collection at Harvard, and she was so helpful. So she's thanked in the beginning, and I've met her since, of course. She's great.
Wonderful. Right.
She was just out in the Badlands, by the way.
Oh, no kidding. So, she knows. I haven't still not been there. I can't wait to see it, see that the piece where the ranch was.
Thank you, Jeff.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks. You never know who's listening
to you.
Isn't
that great?
Yeah, never know. Let's go to Jim in Hollandale. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I was wondering if Doris Kearns Goodwin knows about the operation of antitrust activities in the United States in the last half of the 20th century as compared to the way it was created during Roosevelt's time.
I wish I did know that. I mean, I know that what changed was that when it was in Roosevelt's time, it was under the Sherman Antitrust Act, which had been passed and was a pretty weak act in many ways. And I know that during Wilson's time, it was the Clayton Antitrust Act, which strengthened, I think, the powers that the government had. And then I know that during FDR's time, interestingly, eventually, when World War II was on the horizon, he relaxed the antitrust regulations because he just wanted to get production in the factories done of ships, tanks, and weapons, et cetera. But that's about it. That's what's so interesting. You know, until you delve into these subjects, that's what's so great about spending so much time on it. You know what you know, and then there's so many things you don't know, because I'd love to know a better answer to your question than that. And maybe someday, if I do something that spans those decades, I'll figure it out.
Thank you, Jim, for the call. I want to know what happened to the public interest in public and private misbehavior. What happened to McClure's? What happened to that kind of journalism?
Well, you know, I think what's so important to know about that kind of journalism is that there was a fervor at that time that they helped create and then sustained itself for a while to really uncover the problems, because there was still such an idealism, and I hope it's still there now, about what America should be and what America was. I mean, people were genuinely shocked to know that these political bosses, as they would read about in Lincoln Steffens, were in league with business communities or criminal world underneath. And when they saw that behavior, they then threw out mayors and governors. People went to jail. So it showed that the country still had a capacity, which I still think it does now. I think the problem now is just that we're so fragmented. There's so many different things we're paying attention to. Our days don't have the leisure to read, like these pieces were 30,000-word pieces. Then there'd be a common conversation about them. They'd form editorials. They'd be newspaper columns. And life was at a different pace then than now, and that's what you worry about. I know these things go on, like ProPublica is doing a lot of this investigative work now, and, you know, obviously there are certain radio stations and television stations that do it, but then so much is on our plate, and we're looking at things all around the world, that to concentrate on any one thing, I think, is harder today than it was back then.
Mm-hmm. Barbara is next in Wapaka. Hello, Barbara.
Hello. I'm so happy to be talking to both of you and to be on the show. And I had a suggestion for the next subject for a book, and that would be Belle La Follette.
Oh,
she was a tremendous progressive and did so much work with her husband and behind the scenes, and I think the world needs to know more about Belle La Follette. And I'd appreciate a book from Doris Kearns Goodwin on that subject.
No, thank you very much, actually. I mean, I know from what I wrote about, because her letters are important to Lincoln Steffens, and when I was working on La Follette's role in the 1912 campaign, because he was at first the progressive champion before Teddy Roosevelt, you know, came rushing in, he possibly would have been the progressive, probably, candidate. And she's an extraordinary person. And I'd love to write about a woman, too, so thank you for that suggestion. And that certainly wouldn't mean, a 7-year book either. If I just focus on one person instead of 20, it might be easier.
Well, the Midwest had an important role in the progressive movement.
Oh, without a question. That was the heart of the progressive movement. I mean, that's what's so interesting to realize. I mean, obviously, Wisconsin, many of the social legislation and the economic legislation that passes at the federal level started in Wisconsin. I mean, it was the experiments in democracy. And in general, I mean, Kansas, Wisconsin, all the Midwest was much further progressive than the East was, partly because of this tariff issue, which was like the big tax issue today. I mean, the Eastern manufacturers wanted protection for their manufacturing, and the Western farmers needed to have lower prices. So the battle began there, but then it moved on to direct democracy and primaries and the anger at the courts for rushing down legislation. So there was a real divide between the West and the East at that time.
Mm-hmm. So is it fun to talk about this still, or after 7 years, are you about ready to let him go?
Not quite. Luckily, what happens is you do feel betraying them by letting them go, because you've been with them so long.
Right.
That's what I felt about FDR when I moved to Lincoln, and then clearly moving from Lincoln to these guys. But then I had the movie to deal with, so Lincoln lived on, and now Steven Spielberg has bought the rights to this movie, to this book as well. So
wonderful.
Hopefully if a movie does get made, then Teddy and Taft will be in my mind and heart, even as I figure out what I'm doing next. So they'll live a little bit longer in my head.
Oh, and I think you should write at least a little article about going to Springfield with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
I'd love to know what happened.
He is an amazing actor and a terrific person.
I mean,
even more than you'd ever know as a person. He's just great.
Well, that performance in Lincoln was just superb, I thought.
He became him. I mean, I thought I was watching the man that I'd been thinking about for all those years when I saw him on the screen.
Oh, and for you to say that is just the ultimate compliment, isn't it?
It was great.
Yeah. Thank you, Doris, so much for being with
us. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me. It was lots of fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks. Doris Kearns Goodwin, her latest book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. I had forgotten that Spielberg did decide he was going to do a movie on this. I wonder who will play everybody. But what a fascinating movie that will be, huh? So the book is a bestseller, and it's a terrific read. And actually, we talked books yesterday. It's one of my top books of 2013. Is that where we are? 2013. And we have a list on our Facebook page of Daniel's favorite books, too, from Boswell. So if you're looking for book suggestions, now is the time to go to our Facebook page. We're at the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we have almost 4,000 fans. We'd like to get above 5,000. KP hopes by the end of the year. That might be wishful thinking, but, you know, we'd like to get to 4,000 at least in the next few days. If you listen to the show, the easiest way is to go to our page on Facebook. Another way is to share with your friends, because we're giving you a lot of information, too, of these terrific guests who are on, and then sometimes there are civil and sometimes not so civil discussions about what it is that we've been talking about. So we'd like to have you come to our Facebook page and share the fan page. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour. Lisa Nabandian did our on-air production today. Great conversations ahead, and we'll be with you again tomorrow.